Today is Monday, September 28th. We're going to talk about proteins, nucleic acids, DNA replication, and protein synthesis. Okay, so we were looking last class period at organic compounds. We covered the carbs, we covered the lipids, and there's two remaining organic compound groups. That's the proteins and nucleic acids. So proteins can be rather large molecules. They're built from building blocks known as amino acids. There's 20 amino acids that make all the proteins that we're aware of on Earth, and our bodies, in fact, use those 20 amino acids to build all sorts of proteins, everything from hair to nails to enzymes to integral proteins in plasma membranes, and we could just keep on listing. Some proteins are considered structural, while others are considered functional. And so if you're a functional protein, you do a job for the body. And guess what structural proteins do?
They make a framework.
Yeah, they build, they make a framework, they form some type of a barrier for your body. So there's a fine line there between what it means to be structural versus a functional protein. We're just going to talk about proteins in general. I think I'm actually page ahead. We were probably on page 22. Let me take you back there. You know, when proteins are built, they have covalent bonds that form between the adjacent amino acids, but it's a little more complicated than your typical covalent bond. In this picture, you'll notice that we're looking at peptide bonds that join amino acids, and it is covalent bonding, and we know that because of what?
The lines,
yeah. So carbon and nitrogen have a single line in between, and what does that indicate?
A covalent bond,
good. And carbon and oxygen have two lines in between, that means a double bond, yeah. And it's also covalent. So this is a kind of a more complicated covalent bond than your typical single bond that holds together two molecules. So when we're thinking about proteins, we think about peptide bonds that join amino acids together. And if you're going to build a protein through dehydration synthesis, you have to allow for this peptide bond to form. What is the type of reaction that breaks down proteins?
Hydrolysis.
Right, good. So hydrolysis would break apart that peptide bond so we could get two separate amino acids. Just something to kind of think about. You know, we're coming full circle here with the conversation from last week. This is what they call the beads on a string appearance for proteins. Every single bead here is meant to be an amino acid, and you can barely see there's a line between the two beads or amino acids. Each single line is representing a peptide bond that holds together those amino acids. Just kind of drives home the point how big proteins can be and how complex their structure is. And so proteins aren't necessarily going to stop at being a beads on a string appearance. They're going to go through a progression of changing shape to reach their final destination. So if you count with me, we go from primary to secondary structure. So that's first structure, second structure. And secondary structure includes what is called an alpha helix or a beta pleated sheet. This is an alpha helix on the right. It looks kind of like a coil, okay? And the beta pleated sheet here on the left looks like an accordion. So this again is probably not the final destination for your proteins. They're going to continue to wrap themselves into another shape that we see here at the tertiary level of structure. So just counting, primary is a bead on a string appearance. Secondary looks like an accordion, beta pleated sheet or an alpha helix. Tertiary looks to me like a bunch of curls and twists and turns. To you and me, this doesn't mean a whole lot, but to the protein, that shape is critical because that shape is going to be driven by the protein's function. Finally, you may have proteins reach what is called the quaternary level of structure. That means what level?
Fourth,
yeah. And I want you to notice these are color-coded. These color codings represent different polypeptides or proteins that have come together. This means that we have a really complex protein, and some examples that fall into that quaternary level category are things like hemoglobin and collagen. Heard of hemoglobin before?
Mm-hmm.
In your bloodstream, right? And what about collagen? Where is that found?
Skin.
In the skin, yes. It's a very important connective tissue fiber. So these two actually reach their quaternary level of structure. That means that they are multiple proteins coming together to form some particular shape. So I think you can notice from looking at collagen, it looks like long strands as opposed to hemoglobin, which looks more globe-shaped. There's a clue, right? Globin and globe shape kind of go hand in hand. So when you're thinking about the jobs these proteins do, you know, to you and me, it doesn't look like a whole lot, but it's very much related to the structure and the function of the protein in the body. Okay, so what we want to talk about then is flip on over to the next page and talk about some types of proteins called enzymes. So let me put it to you this way. Enzymes do a job. Would you classify them as functional proteins or as structural?
Functional.
Good. They are functional. Good. And what is the job they do?
They speed up reactions.
Good. They speed up chemical reactions. And for that reason, we call them?
Catalyst.
Good. All right. So they do speed up chemical reactions. We call them biological catalysts. And you'll notice at the top of the page a definition for metabolism. That's how enzymes assist us. They make sure that your chemical reactions are running at the rate they should. So metabolism is defined as what?
The
sum of all chemical reactions.
Good. Sum of all chemical reactions in the body. Good. And so that includes building reactions, dehydration, synthesis, and breakdown, or hydrolysis. So enzymes help in doing both of those types of reactions. I want you to notice the shape of the enzyme and the shape of the substrate. Anything looks special about the shape where they should fit together?
Because there's only one type of substrate that can fit a specific enzyme.
Good. Only one substrate can fit with an enzyme. So the place where they join is very specific, and it's called what?
Active
site. Good. And so it's kind of like having a key for a lock. Only one key should fit that lock, just like your key at the house. That's the same thing here, is that enzymes should pretty much fit only one type of substrate. So enzymes can break down those substrates. Enzymes can help join together those substrates. They can do both breakdown reactions and building reactions on the same substrate. So we've got this image here of activation energy. On Wednesday of last week, we talked about endergonic and exergonic reactions. Do you recall which type requires an input of energy?
Endergonic.
Good. So imagine that your task all by yourself is to take a 400-pound lead ball and roll it up a hill. Well, by ourselves, that's a pretty big task, right? So if your job by yourself is to take the ball up this very tall red hill, you would huff, you would puff, you would work, you would sweat, you would get exhausted, it would
probably
take a
die.
Long time. What else would happen?
You'd probably die.
It would roll back over us and squish us. Okay, so that doesn't sound like a very fun plan to do by yourself. Along comes an enzyme, and the enzyme is going to say, hey, I'm going to save you a whole bunch of trouble. The enzyme says, let me mow down your heel and let's cut your heel in half. And not only that, I'm going to help you push that 400-pound ball up and over that heel. So together, you and the enzyme do the work, and it's very much easier. You don't burn yourself up quite as much getting that ball rolled up and over that heel. What I'm talking about is the energy that's required to get the reaction to run. So by yourself, you got a whole lot of work to do, right? But with a buddy like an enzyme, the enzyme says, I'm going to save you the energy, the activation energy, to get this reaction running. So that's what we say about enzymes. They lower the amount of energy required to run a chemical reaction. In effect, they lower the energy. They've cut that hill in half that we're required to roll that 400-pound lead ball. So enzymes are going to be helpful for us, and so they're beneficial to making our metabolism work more efficiently. Okay, so we don't want our enzymes to become denatured, and I want to show you, go back here to the structure. If you denature an enzyme, What does that mean you're doing to its shape?
Changing
its shape. Good. And what particular part of your enzyme do we especially not want to bother?
The active site.
Good. I kind of think of your enzyme as a delicate thing. You know, it doesn't want to be bothered. Don't mess with it. Because if you mess with that active site, it says, I'm not doing my job. You messed with me. So I'm no longer able to fit with my active site. What are some things that could happen in your body that could mess with that active site?
Drugs.
Probably the overuse of the enzyme.
Drugs. Drugs would do it.
Well, but illnesses.
Yes, illnesses can do it. Let's take the illness one. We're really concerned when you've got a fever like 103, 104, 105, 108. Yeah, those are really high fevers, right? Heat is one thing that can help to denature your enzyme. So what happens to the active site in high heat?
It'll
change shape. And once you change it, can you make it go back to its original form? No. Let me put it to you this way. If you fry an egg in a frying pan and then you decide later that you want it to be back as a raw egg, good luck with that, right? That's not going to work. Yep, so enzymes are the same thing. They're going to change their shape under high heat conditions and then they don't go back. I like that you brought up drugs. That's a good one. Ecstasy sets your hypothalamus, which is your temperature control center in your brain, higher. So for most of us, our body temp is something like 97, maybe 98 or 99. Ecstasy can reset your body temperature 103, 105, 108. And then so your body temperature heats up and it thinks that is the normal temperature, and that can denature your enzymes. So that's a really good example to bring up. What are some other kinds of chemical conditions that can change or denature your enzymes? What is blood pH? 7.35 to 7.45. And if you fall below 7.35, your problem is?
Acidosis.
Most of us are battling acidosis all the time. We don't tend to go up into alkalosis. So if you're battling acidosis, acidosis can also denature your enzymes. Diabetics, people who have insulin issues, are going to be ones that are more battling ketoacidosis than the rest of us. So acidosis and heat are two bad things for your enzymes. They can denature your proteins, including your enzymes, and change their active sites. Okay, so something about that acid condition makes your proteins unravel, reforms their shape. If you've ever pickled eggs, we're back to eggs again, right? If you've ever pickled eggs, you can take a raw egg and basically just hard boil it in an acid environment, right? So that's what acid does, is it changes the shape of our enzymes and our proteins, causing a permanent change in their active sites. And that's no good if we're looking to function properly. Okay, on the bottom of your page down there, a couple of blanks to fill in. You've got a chemical reaction that you're looking at. This happens to be a breakdown reaction. What would you name this kind of reaction?
Hydrolysis,
that's right, good. So on the far left, you'll notice that we've got lactase and lactose coming together. Which one of those is your enzyme?
Lactase,
good. How do you know lactase?
ASE.
And that means it's an enzyme, yeah. And OSE typically means I'm a carbohydrate, yeah, I'm a sugar, I'm a carb. So you'll notice the naming scheme here. The enzyme is usually named for the substrate that it works on. Lactase typically works on lactose. So lactase is your enzyme, lactose is your substrate. Lactase is your enzyme, lactose is your substrate. The middle picture shows where your enzyme and substrate come together at a special place called Active site, good. And we've produced products over here on the far right. These products are breakdown products of hydrolysis. Water would actually be on your reacted side on the far left. What was the other question?
Is that the substrate?
Substrate was lactose, okay. And these are just your products. Yeah, the last one's your products. How about questions on enzymes? Our last type of organic compound is a nucleic acid. They're over on page 24. So, of course, we don't want to confuse terms here. Nucleic acid and amino acid are not related directly. Nucleic acids are just simply a category of chemical compounds in our bodies that include DNA, RNA, and what else?
ATP.
Good. You know, we kind of fall into the habit of saying that these are, you know, storing some kind of genetic information, and then along comes ATP and busts up that thing. So we can't really assume that all of our nucleic acids are storing genetic info. DNA and RNA do work with your genetic code, but ATP is an energy molecule, so it doesn't fit that bill. So you may wonder why ATP is placed in the category with these other nucleic acids like DNA and RNA, and it has to do with the structure. What is the building block of DNA, RNA, and ATP?
Nucleotides.
Good. And nucleotides have three components: a sugar, a phosphate group, and what else?
Nitrogen base.
Nitrogen-containing base. Good. So let me take you down below and look at DNA, RNA, and ATP and talk about their nucleotide structure. We know that a nucleotide of DNA contains a phosphate group represented in this picture by a P. Okay, we know that the sugar here happens to be deoxyribose. There's the name, of course, for DNA, right? Deoxyribose. How did you know deoxyribose was a sugar? The OSC, that's right. So there's sugar molecules, and then there's actually four different nitrogen-containing bases. We have G here representing guanine. What about C? Cytosine. And let's see, A? Adenine. And T?
Thymine,
good. And you actually may recognize a bunch of this stuff. Do you see these dotted lines holding together cytosine and guanine, adenine and thymine? What kinds of bonds are those? Hydrogen, good. And then you've got single lines connecting the sugars and the phosphates. Those are what types of bonds?
Covalent.
Single covalent bonds, good. So, interesting structure here. You've got repetitive sugars and phosphates that make up the sides of the ladder of DNA. And the rungs of the ladder, as if you would climb and put your feet, are made of these alternating pairs of bases. Adenines and thymines pair, cytosines and guanines pair. And to save space in your nuclei, this DNA molecule will twist itself up like a spiral staircase, and that allows us to store your entire genetic code inside the nucleus of a cell. Kind of amazing to think that your entire code is not even visible to the naked eye. But yet, if we were to take it and lay it all out, it codes for everything about you. So kind of a crazy concept there of what a blueprint storage device this is. Let's contrast RNA with DNA. What here is the same? Let's do that first.
Phosphate group.
Good. Phosphate group's the same. Ribose is different, yeah. We've got a few same bases, right? Adenine, guanine, cytosine, but this time we don't have thymine. What do we use instead?
Uracil.
Uracil, good. Another difference is the sugar is slightly different. Instead of deoxyribose, this time it's ribose. Okay, and then how many strands do we have here in RNA?
One.
Just one. Compare that back to DNA. DNA has two strands linked together. There's one strand. There's your second strand. So in fact, the molecules are a little bit different. One strand in RNA versus two in DNA. Do you know why RNA is used in our bodies?
To make proteins.
Make proteins, good. Let me put it to you this way. If you take your blueprint of DNA outside the nucleus, first of all, it's too big to take. But if you take your only blueprint and something happens to it, what happens to your cell? It can't perform its functions, yeah. So it's like taking your brain out of your head and saying, I'll put it back when I'm done, and I dropped it on the floor and I had an accident, and sorry. That's why we don't take the DNA out of the cell's nucleus, right? It's so important you leave it alone in the nucleus. And what you do is you make copies called RNA. So RNA is a photocopy of DNA, and you take the RNA outside the nucleus. Hey, if it gets damaged, so what? You can always go back to your blueprint and make another copy. Okay, so that's why we have RNA. It's a copy used to make proteins. So last is ATP. Why did we say it's in this category?
It's an energy molecule.
And it's built from? Nucleotides. Yeah, built from nucleotides. And the building blocks or components of an ATP nucleotide are?
Three
phosphate groups. Good.
A five-valent sugar.
Good.
Nitrogen base.
Adenine. Good. So a little different than your typical nucleotide. This time, instead of only one phosphate group, we have three phosphate groups. We do have ribose here as a sugar. That, of course, O-S-E ending is our clue. And we do have one base this time, just only one, and it's adenine. So there's some similarities here to our other molecules in this category. But then, of course, that three phosphate groups at the end is what makes this group special. So what is ATP doing for us in our bodies? It's energy for the body, right? I kind of think of it like somebody handing me one of those Visa cards, you know, that's got preloaded some money on it. Oh, yeah, right. And so you've got like a couple thousand dollars loaded on an ATP molecule, and anytime you want to do work, here you go. Okay? So ATP is the high energy form of this molecule. If I take off one of those phosphate groups, I'm only left with two, and I'm down to a lower energy form called ADP, diphosphate. So we really want to have ATP with the higher energy form. Okay, so that should do it for this page. Do you have questions about DNA or RNA? So this was Vic to cover this today because we're going to talk more about nucleic acids in a few minutes. Let me get you into cell information. Let me flip you on over a few pages. We're going to look at page 28. So what I'd like to do is talk to you about just a generic cell, and we're going to talk about the three structures that are common to those cells. And then we're going to talk about how the nucleus plays a role for controlling that cell. Before we get all into the nitty-gritty details here, what I'd like to show you is the Cell Scale, which is a really cool website out at the University of Utah. So this is a really neat website, and what they do is they kind of give you an idea of how tiny the cell and its components are. You're looking at some things that you can probably see with the naked eye, including a coffee bean, a rice grain, and a grain of salt. And we've probably all seen these things with relatively little problem with the naked eye. As you scroll across the bottom of this scale, you'll notice that we are getting more magnified, and barely visible to the naked eye is what's called an amoeba. And you may or may not be able to see these because these are actually on the scale of a micron. That's what that UM stands for. That's a micrometer. And most likely you're going to need a microscope to be able to see that amoeba up close and all of the structures of it. You definitely can't see the structure of the paramecium. It's too tiny to see with the naked eye. And the thing that you might be able to see with the naked eye here is a human egg. It fits on the head of a pin, but you know it's small compared to everything that we're looking at so far, but it's actually the biggest cell in the human body, which is kind of an awesome thing. Let's see, as we scroll in, we're looking at other cells here in the human body. There's a skin cell and a sperm, and then you see some stuff right there in the very center of the screen that's barely visible. Let's zoom in and see what that is. Yeah, chromosomes, red blood cells, grains of yeast, and even smaller there in the center of the screen, yeah, there's E. coli. Okay, so now we're down at the level of organelles like mitochondria, lysosomes, bacteria like E. coli, and then look at all of this stuff here that you can't even see yet. We are still dealing with micrometers. And then now we're dealing with nanometers. So 10 to the negative 9th meters, that's incredibly small. Definitely have to have a microscope to see this stuff. So you've got viruses here that you're taking a look at. Even smaller stuff yet to come. Rhinovirus, that's what's giving us colds every fall, winter, spring, and well, summer too, right? So look how tiny that thing is. No wonder they say to wash your hands, because it's so tiny it can ride between your fingers or under your fingernails with no problem. And then even smaller stuff to come. You know, we were talking about hemoglobin earlier today. It's incredibly small, but in terms of molecules in our body, it's actually quite big. So, you know, it's kind of a weird concept there to think about how big hemoglobin is, but really it's small in terms of the scale of everything else. Even smaller stuff yet to come. There we've got glucose in picometers. That's 10 to the negative 12 meters. We've got adenine. We were talking about that. It's a component of our nucleic acids. And we've also got things like a water molecule and dead center. You can barely see it, a carbon atom. So kind of a cool website to give you the sense of scale here and what we're dealing with. Let me just ride back out. Yeah, that is pretty cool. Yeah. Okay. We are looking like we're starting on page 28 then. So we've known about cells for about 400 years. The first person to describe them was back in the 1600s. The man was named Robert Hooke. That sounds like a pirate to me, but he in fact was a monk living in a monastery. And he must have had some time on his hands because he sampled cork that was shoved into a wine bottle. And what he saw probably looked something like this, just with these simple walls that formed these cells. And then nowadays, we're a little more fancy. Nowadays, we have all these different stains and dyes that we can use that really make those cell structures glow. This is a time that I do want to mention that when you start studying tissues in lab, to not get too hung up on a color of the tissue, because sometimes they'll stain them pink or purple, other times they'll stain them like a blue color. And if you get hung up and say, well, I know that dense irregular is always stained pink, boom, on the test it'll be a purple one. So I just don't want you to fall into the trap of memorizing by color. Hey, if you can print the pictures in a good quality black and white image, that's probably just as good. That way your brain doesn't get tricked into getting those colors there memorized. This is a bacterial cell, which is very simple compared to our complex cells. You'll notice in the center here some DNA. And there's no nucleus here, so there's no protective device around that DNA. So we think of our cells as a little more sophisticated because we do have a protective nuclear envelope around our DNA. When you do cheek cell swabs in lab, this may be what you see if you had a really good powered microscope. In fact, what you see in our labs probably looks a little more like this. But you do get a sense of the main parts of your typical cell. You've got a cell membrane or plasma membrane around the outside. What is this structure in the center called?
Nucleus.
Good. And the jelly-like stuff inside the cell?
Cytoplasm.
Good. All right. So why don't we turn our attention first to the plasma membrane? You can call it plasma membrane. You can call it cell membrane. And we believe that the cell membrane is actually a fluid state. And if you think about us being mobile animals, it makes sense that our cell membranes must be somewhat fluid. In fact, our cell membranes are liquid. So they have the ability to shift items from one location to another based on need. What are the two layers of your typical plasma membrane? What type of organic compound?
Lipids.
And they are phospholipids. Good. So let's look closely at a phospholipid for just a moment. These phospholipids have a glycerol head and two fatty acid chains. Okay. The glycerol head happens to be polar. Those two fatty acid chains happen to be?
Non-polar.
You got it. Non-polar. Good. So which portion of your fat likes and gets along with water?
The head.
The head. Good. So we have a term for this. We say the heads are hydrophilic because they like water and get along with water. What do we say about those two tails?
Hydrophobic.
And what does that mean?
A fear of water.
So if you have trouble keeping it straight, think about it this way. You know, if you fuss at a dog and you say, don't do that again, and you hurt their feelings, they tuck their tails and run, don't they? So the tails are the part that are scared. They're going to be scared of water. Therefore, they hide toward the inside of the membrane. And in fact, that's what we see. All these brave hydrophilic heads are oriented outward where they can contact water. And those scared hydrophobic tails, they're oriented toward the inside of your plasma membrane. Okay? So that's part of our plasma membrane structure, is a bilayer or two layers of phospholipids. What else do we find here? Proteins, good. What type of protein travels all the way through your plasma membrane? Integral. Yeah, integral proteins travel all the way through your plasma membrane. And what type of protein sits only on one surface of your membrane?
Peripheral.
Good. Two layers of our sandwich. We're going to put two pieces of bread on the outside. We're going to put some meat on the inside. The two pieces of bread on the outside are your polar phospholipid heads. The meat on the inside of your sandwich are the non-polar hydrophobic tails. Polar heads are hydrophilic, they love water. The heads are hydrophobic, they're scared of water. Let's pretend that I made a really big sandwich and I need to hold it together with a toothpick. So I'm going to put a toothpick all the way through my membrane to help hold it together. That's going to be an integral protein, where it's going to shove it all the way through the entirety of our membrane. Do y'all need lights on? Good? Okay.
You guys sign in first.
Everybody sign in? Oh, and on our toothpick, let's put an olive on there. And the olive's not going to go all the way through our sandwich. The olive is just going to sit on one side on the outside of our sandwich. So let's put right there our olive. And what kind of protein is that going to be?
Peripheral.
That's peripheral. Good. Your membrane include cholesterol molecules. You know, cholesterol gets a bad reputation. You know, we make a lot of our own cholesterol. We also get cholesterol from food. But bottom line is, you got to have cholesterol to make your cell membranes. And you can see little molecules of cholesterol stuffed in between those phospholipid bilayers. We also have a very fancy external surface to our cell membrane. You'll notice out here we've got things like glycoproteins and carbohydrate chains. These surface features act as recognition proteins. They act to glue and bind and stick one cell to a neighboring cell. So there's a lot of sticky business going on the outside surface of our cells. And I literally mean it is a sticky business. The outside surface is a sugary coating, kind of like an M&M, and it allows for one cell to stick to the neighboring cell. And so you may wonder, how do you carry around trillions of cells without falling apart? And part of it has to do with the stickiness of the external surface. Because it is sticky, we call it the glycocalyx. That word, by the way, is on your worksheet underneath the carbohydrate component. Okay, glycocalyx refers to the outer surface, which is sticky. And by the way, letter A in your picture down below is the glycocalyx. That'll work too. Carbohydrate chain will work too. It is also part of the glycocalyx. Since we're looking at that picture, do you recognize letter B?
Polar
head, good. And how about letter C? That works. Good. Nonpolar tails for letter C. And letter D?
Integral protein.
Good. Integral protein. And one more there, letter E?
Peripheral protein.
Yeah, peripheral protein. Good. So we've talked a lot about the fancy structure of our plasma membrane. Let's talk about the function. Because of the nature of those phospholipid tails, we think of our plasma membrane as a selectively permeable or semi-permeable membrane. Does that mean everything that wants to cross your membrane can get through? Yeah, only certain things can get through, right. So this membrane serves as a boundary, it serves as a barrier, and it serves to choose what comes across into the interior of the cell. Just not everything can come across the membrane into the inside. All right, so let's see. One more item down there near the bottom of your page. We've got the cytoplasm, which is a common feature to most of our cells. And the way I would describe cytoplasm is kind of like a bowl full of jello. So it's a jelly-like consistency. The cytoplasm contains fluid that we call intracellular fluid. What's another name for that ICF?
Cytosol.
Cytosol, good. And we also have solutes and electrolytes inside that cytoplasm. And we also have organelles being held into place by this jelly-like fluid. Looks good enough to eat. Oh, we needed some fruit cocktail. We'd have a real sale, right? So I kind of think of it's an overwhelming thought to think that we have around 20-some liters of fluid inside of our cells. It really drives home how much water we're toting around. Cytosol is the number one storage site for water in your body. So there's three components common to most cells. We've covered plasma membrane. We just talked about cytoplasm. And the third structure is over on the next page, and that is the nucleus. Most cells have a nucleus. There are exceptions. Red blood cells, for instance, have no nucleus, and so therefore they have no way to think or repair themselves or run any of their day-to-day activities. It's kind of overwhelming to think about cells that may live for months in your bodies that have no brain, but that's the case with a red blood cell. Most of our cells have a nucleus, so they can repair themselves, so they can grow and know how to function. That's what that nucleus is there for, to kind of direct the activities of that cell. In this picture, the nucleus is pretty much the largest structure that you see. It's right here. And what type of nucleic acid is stored inside your nucleus?
DNA.
Good. All right, so let's talk about the parts here. The first structure you've got is called a nuclear envelope. And I think of a nuclear envelope like a wiffle ball. So if you've ever seen a wiffle ball before, you notice they're full of holes. They're very lightweight. And that's where we're going to store our most precious commodity, our DNA, is inside a wiffle ball. So why in the world would you want to put your very precious DNA inside a structure that's poked full of holes?
Because eventually the DNA has to come out and make RNA to make protein.
You're kind of on the right track. So we don't want the DNA to leave. But what do we want to come out of those holes? You have it.
The RNA.
Yeah. So imagine this. Imagine taking your boss or your brain and locking it in a closet and say, okay, you're not to communicate with the rest of us. Then there's no way for that boss or that brain to be able to give out directions. Those holes are there for communication with the rest of your cell. And like you guys said, is to let that RNA out of the nucleus. It works both ways. Things like viruses can get into the nucleus. You know, we've got other bad stuff that can attack our nuclei, but that is just the nature of what it means to have communication go on with the parts of your cell. Okay. The next structure listed there is called the nucleoplasm. This is like cytoplasm. It just tells you where it's located. Where is nucleoplasm found?
Nucleus,
good. How would you describe it? Bingo, jelly-like substance like cytoplasm, good. Okay, and then finally you've got the nucleoli or nucleolus, which is a condensed region inside your nucleus. This is kind of like the hub of the party inside your nucleus. You've got all of this nucleoplasm and chromatin, which is basically DNA that's been in its relaxed state, kind of like yarn that is unraveled. That's what chromatin looks like. But then the real party here is going on in that nucleolus. That's where you have a condensed region of DNA. Let me take the yarn and kind of ball it up. And you've got proteins that help to wrap it and hold it into place. So this dark spot that you see inside the nucleus is the party. That's the nucleolus. Everywhere else, you may see something that looks like a fuzzy mess when you look at cells. And that's the chromatin, which is more like an unraveled yarn appearance.
Okay.
It's kind of the core, yeah, and it's where most of the DNA is housed up like a little ball. Y'all doing so far so good with stuff today? Okay. Got any questions? Anything I can clarify for you?
Did you say that the chromatin is like DNA that is relaxed?
It is. I kind of think of it like unraveled yarn.
Yeah.
So let's go back and review DNA structure for just a moment. We know that DNA is built from building blocks called what?
Nucleotides.
Good. And the nucleotides make these repetitive rungs of bases that go up and across. So we've got A's and T's that pair, C's and G's that pair. And to save space, this double helix is going to be twisted into this shape and stored inside your nucleus. It's never going to leave your nucleus. That is its safe place. We only take copies out through those nuclear pores. The copies are called what?
RNA.
RNA, right. Okay. So I wanted to talk about the difference between chromatin and chromosomes in terms of explaining how DNA exists. Okay, so when your nucleus is kind of in a resting state, our DNA exists kind of like this unraveled yarn. It's in a relaxed state. It's like it's on a Saturday, it's laying at home in its underwear, it ain't going nowhere, okay? So that is chromatin, it's relaxed DNA. If somebody calls and says, oh, we're having a party, get dressed, then DNA gets into a more formal structure that we call a chromosome. It's still DNA, it just happens to be dressed up a little more than this relaxed chromatin look. So when the cell actually gets ready to undergo cell division, we're gonna see it appear as this chromosome. Now, let me blow your mind. These are both chromosomes. Whoops, there we go. These are both chromosomes. So what is the difference between them?
And then the chromosome is the one that's relaxed.
Okay, so we got chromatin, right? That's the yarn. And these are both chromosomes. And one of them is single-stranded, and the other one is double-stranded, right. So they're both chromosomes. It just means that one chromosome actually has a second set or copy of DNA, and it's ready to undergo cell division, okay? And so the only time you're going to see the chromosomes appear is when you're getting ready for mitosis or cell division. So that's where I'd like to take you next, just to kind of walk you through the steps of DNA replication. You may have seen this before in a previous bio class. And the catch here is, it's gonna be hard to work with a double-stranded, twisted-up structure. The first thing that we're gonna have to do is lay that DNA out straight so that we can start to make base pairs and copies of that DNA. Okay, so you've seen the cell cycle before. Is this something that's brand new? Okay. So you've probably heard about interphase and then mitosis. Interphase includes gap one, S phase, and gap two. And they sometimes call these growth phases instead of gap phases. But we're going to focus instead on this S phase or synthesis phase. What does synthesis mean?
Creation.
We're going to create, we're going to make, and in fact, we're going to make a single-stranded chromosome turn into a double-stranded chromosome. So this is good old dehydration synthesis. And so we need to take our single-stranded DNA and turn it into a double-stranded set. That way we have a set to give away to our new cell and a set for us to keep. Once we travel around clockwise here to prophase, we have to be ready with double-stranded chromosomes. And so that way we can give a set away of DNA to our new cell, and we can keep a set for our old parent cell, okay? So we're in this phase here called the synthesis phase. It's gonna last around 24 hours. All right, so I'm gonna think about our DNA like I would a zipper. And so here's my problem. In order to copy the DNA, I need to expose the base pairs. The base pairs are adenine, thymine, cytosine, and guanine. Do those base pairs form the sides of the ladder of the DNA or the rungs where you put your feet?
The rungs.
The rungs where you put your feet. Yes, so go back and look at this. Here's those base pairs, and I need to expose those. right now, my DNA is twisted up like a spiral staircase. My goal is to lay it flat and, like a zipper, unzip it so that I can expose those base pairs. If you've got 46 chromosomes, you don't want to start with chromosome number 1 and work your way to chromosome 46. We'd still be dividing if that was the case. You start doing this all over all your chromosomes simultaneously. That way you speed the process up and it only takes 24 hours. So that's what we see here. We've unzipped and unwound those double strands from each other, and we've got them laying out straight like this. And our job now is to bring in complementary base pairs. What we have to keep in mind is we're going to use our old DNA as a parent or a template strand, and we're going to build a new daughter strand from that parent or template. So when I'm thinking about adenine, what should always pair with adenine?
Thymine.
Thymine pairs with adenine. What about cytosine? What does that pair with?
Guanine.
Good. So G's and C's, C's and G's pair. A's and T's, T's and A's pair. So if you can keep 4 letters of the alphabet straight, you've got this made.
Can you?
Okay. Sure. A's and T's, T's and A's. C's and G's, G's and C's.
C's and G's, G's and C's.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. And I'd like to go through this with you guys on the board. Do is I'm going to assume that I've already untwisted my DNA. I'm going to unzip it. We're going to expose the parent strands, those template strands, and I'm going to write parent here. It's a template strand. Just bubbled open a piece of our double-stranded DNA. I am trying to do DNA replication and turn a single-stranded chromosome into a double-stranded chromosome. I'll give y'all a minute to catch up with me. Perform DNA replication. This is a synthesis process, and we're going to use the parent strand to guide our daughter strand formation. Keep in mind our 4 bases, A's and T's, T's and A's pair, G's and C's, C's and G's pair. Okay, and that's all we got to do is keep those letters straight and just go for base pairing here. I'm going to start you at the top. A pairs with T, T pairs with A. G, good.
C.
Good.
C.
Okay.
G. T. A. A.
Got it. All right. And while we're at it, let's do the daughter strand for the bottom parent.
T. A. C. G. G. C. A. T. T.
Gotcha. Okay. Got a built-in self-check too, right? So each daughter strand should look like the opposite other parent strand, so you can kind of double-check yourself to make sure you did it correctly. Is this something you feel comfortable doing? So if I gave you a DNA strand, the parent on the test and I said, hey, can you provide the complement for me? You can provide the daughter strand for me? Okay. So if you use your imagination and think about this as a double-stranded chromosome laying on its side, you can see what we just did by bubbling apart those two double strands of DNA. We've now created an identical set of DNA here, an identical set up here. And what happens to this chromosome during metaphase? Separate it. Here is your metaphase plate going right through there. And this top piece goes to one cell, the bottom piece goes to another cell, and I think it's pretty obvious that what we get in each new cell is going to be identical sets of DNA. Okay, and so what we did was replicate a single-stranded chromosome into a double-stranded chromosome solely for the purpose of undergoing mitosis. So what was the process of copying the DNA known as?
Replication.
Good. This is called DNA replication. And you can think of it as copying your DNA, synthesizing it, making an identical strand set so that we can give one away. Near the bottom of your page, you do have two blanks there to fill in. And this is on the bottom of page 29. Each new double strand of DNA contains a parent strand and a daughter strand. Parent strand and a daughter strand. Give you another copy at the bottom if you'd like to try one more chance at doing DNA replication. That's going to be a point and a half question come test number one. Okay. Feel pretty good here? Okay. So not as bad as you. That's good. Anybody need a picture of the board before we go on? I'm going to erase this. Anybody else need a picture? Our next page is page 30. Okay, so we're going to kind of switch gears here. We're done talking about DNA replication, and now we're talking about protein synthesis. So I want you to tuck DNA replication somewhere else in your brain for just a moment. And let's now switch into this different topic. Protein synthesis is a process that's driven, run by your nucleus, because your DNA contains instructions, because it's the blueprint for how to make your proteins. Now, going back to think about the DNA structure, DNA is too big to be able to pull out of your nucleus, so it has to stay neatly stored inside your nucleus. It is safest in there, plus it's too big to pull out through one of those nuclear pores anyway. If we want to make a protein, what we'll do then instead is we'll take the blueprint of your DNA, we'll select an appropriate region that codes for making a protein, and we'll simply make a copy of that region. The copy of that DNA is called what?
RNA.
Good. So it is the RNA that we're going to let leave through that nuclear pore and travel out into our cytoplasm. So, let's see. When we're thinking about this whole cell cycle, the place where you make new proteins is actually during these G phases. They're sometimes called growth 1 instead of gap 1 and growth 2, but this is where a cell adds to its population of proteins. So this is where protein synthesis should occur, is in those G1 and G2 periods of interphase. Okay, so in terms of RNA structure, let's review those parts of an RNA molecule one more time. An RNA molecule is made up of a building block called what?
Nucleotide,
good. A typical nucleotide for RNA contains a phosphate group,
a sugar, and a carbohydrate,
nitrogenous base, good. So let's see, we've got a phosphate group, this time our sugar is ribose, and we've got four possible nitrogen-containing bases. They are adenine, guanine, cytosine, and uracil, okay? So I got to switch things up this time just a little bit. C's and G's, G's and C's still pair. Okay, but what about adenine? What does it now pair with?
With
uracil. Yeah, so we've lost thymine, and we're going to replace it with uracil. So this time, adenine and uracil, A's and U's pair, U's and A's pair. Okay, just a one little twist up in our story comes from uracil. All right, so the whole goal here is for us to make proteins. We make proteins during interphase of the cell cycle, and we start off by making proteins in the nucleus. We have to take a copy of your DNA out through your nuclear pore and into the cytoplasm. That copy is called an RNA molecule. So we're going to leave the DNA safely stored inside the nucleus. Protein synthesis is actually two steps. It is a step called transcription and a step called translation. So instead of making you guys strain your eyes to look at this picture here, let me raise the screen and we'll put something on the board for you to copy down if you like. Remember to bring some spray because I know that looks awful. Can you see that okay, the DNA strand? Okay. Directions to make a protein are stored in the DNA molecule. Where is DNA housed?
In the nucleus.
In the nucleus, good. To make a protein, I first copy my DNA into an RNA molecule. What I have to remember, though, is that RNA does not have
thymine.
Right? No thymine in the RNA, so I replace thymine with
uracil.
Good. So that's the thing I have to keep straight when we're doing this transcription process. Keep in mind, we're transcribing DNA into RNA in the nucleus. The DNA is too big to leave through nuclear pore, and we don't want to take it out into the cytoplasm where it may get damaged. So let's do transcription first. Of course, T can bind with A, and that's okay. A normally pairs with T, but not for RNA. It's a U. Good. Yeah, you got it. If the whole thymine uracil thing trips you up, what I recommend is going ahead and putting the T's there, erasing them and replacing them with U's. So that's the thing we got to keep straight, is that RNA contains uracil. Thymine is found only in the DNA molecule. So this RNA molecule is going to leave through one of those nuclear pores. That RNA molecule that we just made is actually a specific type of RNA that we call messenger RNA. Instead of saying messenger RNA, let's just shorten it up and say it's mRNA. So I know that when you look at that strand of RNA, you don't really know what kind of protein that's going to make. What we need is a translating device. And you've actually got a translating device in the bottom of your worksheet. You have what's called a codon chart. Hidden in this message carried by mRNA are codes. How many base pairs make up a code?
Three.
Good. And if you take a moment, you can just count off by threes. There's AUG, there's one code. CCG, there's another one. And UAA. So these are called codons, not condoms. I've had people call them condoms on a test. Yep, they're codons. So there's 1, 2, 3 codons here, right? They made for a good laugh. I don't know how many years ago that was, but it's made me laugh ever since. So now comes the part where you can use your codon chart on the bottom of the page. Let me give you a moment to use the chart. Remember to look them up by codons and write down your three codons on your sheet.
So you write what's beside it?
Yeah, like just for example, UUU is phenylalanine. You're right, so whatever's to the direct right of that code. I know we're running short on time. What about AUG?
Start.
Good. And CCG?
Proline.
Good.
Wouldn't you AA be stop?
It'd be stop, yep. Ideally, I will give you a protein longer than one amino acid. This is not really a protein, it's just an amino acid. But what I will do to make sure that you're doing this correct on the test is give you a start and a stop codon. That way, you know you've done the translation portion correct. I'd like to do this again on Wednesday, just one more time to make sure we're comfortable. There is one done for you there in your worksheet, but I will restart you here Wednesday, and then we'll move into membrane transport. If you will, please read for the organelles in your course pack. I'll skip them and not cover them in class, but instead we'll move on to membrane transport on Wednesday.